So, my name is Joseph Patrick. I wanted to first of all thank the boys from Ruthless Criticism for inviting me. It's a Marxist website that they run with all kinds of different texts. You can ask them later for the exact name of the website. I am from the German Marxist Quarterly, with the somewhat awkward name, at least for American ears, Gegenstandpunkt. Essentially means something like counterpoint. And what I wanted to talk about today was the current U.S. healthcare reform. If there are any questions during the talk, go ahead and ask them. We can discuss about anything. At the same time, I'll reserve my right to postpone the question if I think it doesn't quite fit in or if I'm going to be dealing with it a little later. But any questions you have, we'll try to address, at least clear up any questions or misunderstandings or comments. At the moment, with regard to the healthcare reform, we're kind of in a state of, well, I guess we're in the twilight zone. Most of the debate is over with. There's a House bill and a Senate bill, and yet the final version of the bill is not quite there. That'll be decided in the middle of January. And what I wanted to start off by talking about, or what I wanted to talk about first, is a few things about the current debate. More specifically, some things about the media coverage. For any of you who haven't been reading the newspapers over the holidays, there's two interesting phenomena I wanted to point out. The one thing is, or the one overarching theme in the newspapers is, what does the healthcare reform mean for the politicians who have set out to reform the healthcare? How and to what extent will politicians manage to achieve what it is that they have set out to do? How will this affect them in the future, their career opportunities, majorities in both chambers of Congress? For instance, will the Democrats manage to get a 60-40 majority and put through a bill? Will Obama succeed in achieving the first element of his, his program of change with regard to domestic policy? What are the implications of the fact that the Republicans, I think almost all of them, are against the bill? Will this affect the Democrats or the Republicans positively or negatively in the upcoming midterm elections? And with questions like that, what is the media expecting of the audience? What should the public be interested in? They should be interested in what this healthcare reform means, well, for the ruling elite. What does this mean for their tactical maneuvers? A healthcare reform comes along, everybody knows, or the idea is that it will radically change the way people get and access medical care. And the overarching issue is, what does this mean for the politicians? A nice little lesson on democracy. The second overarching theme in the literature, well, in the newspapers, in television, are a slew of comparisons and tabular calculations on what the two different reform bills might mean for various portions of the population. So whether for seniors on Medicare, for small businesses, for employees in small businesses and large businesses, major corporations, what does it mean for families, etc. And what people can do and are encouraged to do is to take a look at the different tabular calculations, follow the ups and downs of the debate, and calculate and speculate for themselves whether they'll be better off or worse off on balance. For most people, this means being stuck in the proverbial rocker between a proverbial rock and a hard place. Either being unable to afford healthcare as it is, or being unable to bear the cost of the obligatory insurance that they'll have to purchase. But what is expected of them here? Well, in this case, they're expected to be what they are: passive objects of the decisions that others make, according to their calculations. What can they do? Well, they can cross their fingers and hope that the reform turns out on balance for them in a beneficial way. And in fact, as cruel as that kind of media coverage might be, it's in fact rather fitting. It really is the case that medical care in this society is not simply a matter of, well, what do people need? That's what people get. Rather, it's a function of what politicians determine according to their calculations, whatever nature they might be. These calculations determine what kind of medical care people get. The people themselves, they're the recipients of that medical care. Poor quality, good quality, expensive or inexpensive. In any case, they have nothing to say. That's why I want to approach the matter in a different way. I don't want to talk about the possible implications of healthcare reform for the tactical maneuvers of politicians, nor do I want to talk about possible implications, ups and downs, for individual parts of the population. Instead, what I want to do is, well, if it's the case that the kind of access to medical care people get depends solely on the calculations that politicians and government have, then it's important to grasp the nature of those calculations. So what I want to do is something more fundamental. What are the calculations that determine what kind and whether people get access to medical care? And that'll involve basically three different questions I want to deal with. Go through three different points, three chapters, if you will. The first point I want to deal with is, what is the state's, the modern capitalist state's, interest in public health, the health of the population? Why is it the case that right in the middle of the free market economy, the government is so extensively involved in the field of medicine and medical care? What are the purposes? What are the origin of that? What is the origin of that involvement? The second point I want to deal with is, how does the state manage health care? How does the state manage the issue of public health in general and for the United States in particular? Why is it the case that healthcare is always too little and costs too much? Why is it in a permanent state of reform? And the third point I want to make, come on in. The third point I want to make, well, I want to talk a little bit about the current reform. Again, it's not a final thing. We don't know what the final bill would look like. But the course that the reform debate has taken is very instructive. I say that it provides a nice lesson about the role of health and healthcare in modern capitalism, and especially in international competition, would be the particularity of the current reform. So again, if there's any questions along the line, just let me know, and maybe we can address them right away, or I'll postpone them to the end. But what I wanted to start off with is, what is the modern capitalist state's interest in public health? Well, one thing that the reform debate has made clear is, the government is extensively involved in the field of medical care. Depending on the decisions that the government makes, the way that people get medical care, the kind of medical care they get, can be changed radically. Now, if, for those of you who followed the debate, you can see there's big differences as we've gone down the line. Maybe 40 or 30 million people more will be insured, maybe 35, it depends. And it's true, in general, the capitalist state is involved in every aspect of medical care. First field is research. Organizes a wide range of programs to promote research in the medical field, to target particular diseases, monitor drugs, regulate drugs, monitor healthcare providers, gather and disseminate information, and deal with healthcare issues of all kind. There's a surgeon general that heads a public health service. Researchers in so-called national institutes of health study causes, seek cures for disease, receive government report and grant support and grants for doing so. And there's a Food and Drug Administration, which sets standards for what standards food production has to meet, or what's in food, or what's in drugs. There are government programs for Medicare for people over 65, also disabled. There's Medicaid for those who are officially deemed poor enough to receive government support, certainly not all of the poor, but those who meet the official criteria, as well as a program to cover the children of uninsured families. Clearly, this state has an interest in some level of medical care. At the lowest level, this means guarding against, well, things like plagues, epidemics that could threaten the entirety of the population. But in no state does it usually stop there. Nor is it the case that the government demand that there be one kind of care for the rich and one kind of care for the poor. What people can afford is a different story. First of all, medicine is something that is classless. It's supposed to be the disease that determines the nature of the care. Nor is it the case that the state says, well, only for those people that are functional for the economy, they're the only ones that get care. The only single-payer insurance that there is for seniors, disabled, and the poor. And this fact, that the state is so extensively involved in healthcare, is what, especially among the left, gives the government such a good reputation. On the left, many on the left would say that the state is there or has a moral obligation to protect people from the vagaries of the market. The state is obligated to help people in need, take care of them when they're sick. And these people will analyze different governments according to this standard. Those states that do take care of the health of the population get an A+. Those that don't get criticized for not living up to one of their major tasks. What's important to note about that is the fact that states are so extensively involved in the field of medical care, the fact that they go to great lengths to organize research, financing, delivery of care, is based on the fact that this very same state organizes and enforces a mode of production that does two things: makes people systematically sick and incapable of accessing the cure. In that sense, the good reputation that this state has is based on the very bad things it does. It has a reputation of protecting people from the vagaries of the economy, the very same economy that this very same state installs, organizes, and enforces. And this is a point that all sides to the healthcare debate simply take for granted. We do find all kinds of discussions and debate about what are the necessities of government healthcare and what are the difficulties of government healthcare. What we don't find is the briefest reflection on what it is that makes people so systematically sick in the first place and so systematically unable to get care. This is also true for the left, or maybe even especially true for the left, when they call on the state to fulfill its obligation. If they do, now I'm talking about the left, they do offer an explanation for this fact. It is that greed on the part of individual corporations or individual employers and moral failings on the part of the business world is at fault. The claim I want to make and prove here is that it's worse than that. This systematic sickness and the systematic inability to get the cure is in fact a necessary consequence of the capitalist economy that this state organizes and enforces. So, how does that work? In what sense is that true? Well, first of all, everybody knows, and these cases are pretty well known, the really extreme cases where this economy makes people sick. So things like BSE, or cancers due to toxic waste of various different kinds. There are movies made about them. They always end up in the headlines about toxic waste landing in the air, the soil, the water. People that are injured because of gross violations to health standards, etc. But the normal everyday cases of sickness, although they're just as well known, they're mostly taken for granted. Well, how? As a modern part of working life. These are the so-called occupational diseases you've all heard about. Cases where work make people sick. And if we take a survey of the working world, well, what do we find? First of all, heavy lifting, the classic, still around in many jobs. Not only in the construction industry do we have arthritis and hernias, but in warehouses and even in the most modern offices, still around. And even in cases where machines take over much of the heavy lifting and moving, the repetitiveness, the one-sidedness, and the sheer length of the working day produces the same result. Ruined backs pretty much across the board, tendonitis of various kinds, carpal tunnel syndrome, also other forms of tendonitis from sitting at a computer screen all day, working on the assembly line, doing other forms of repetitive tasks. Not a big secret. Also in many industries, depending on what industry you're looking at, we find prolonged exposure to heat, dust, dirt, noise, and toxins of various sorts. Certainly hasn't died out. The working day is long. What does that cause? Insomnia, sleep disorders of various kinds, digestive and nerve disorders, exhaustion, burnout.
Mental anguish.
That's one of them. We want to get to that point right now because the working day is not only long, it's also very intense. Cardiovascular diseases are the result, high blood pressure, stomach problems, even for managers, the famous manager problem, and above all, the modern slogan, stress. I'm sure any of you could go on and list various kinds of diseases that arise from the working world. And none of that is a secret. All of these ailments are well known. But for the most part, they get taken for granted. How? Well, it's just a part of modern working life. It's a part of our modern society. If we want this kind of well-being, we need to work. We need to work hard, and work can make people sick. I think my favorite example of this, and probably the most well-known to you, are these great TV advertisements for pain and headache medication and cold medication also. It's always great when I come and visit in America and get to watch TV. They're all over the place. And what's nice about them is that they're these mini vignettes on individual workers' biographies. You just get presented to you how the working world makes you sick. Headache, pains of all kinds, hurting backs. And what's the solution? Well, drugs. Why? What you realize in these commercials is that the fact that they're sick is the least of their problems. The real danger is that the sickness might lead to them not being able to go into work the next day. Yeah, think about these commercials saying, thank goodness I was able to go in and perform the task that I'm supposed to. Either that my boss expects of me or that I need to take care of in order to make a living. If their sickness leads to them not being able to go into work, that's the real threat to their existence. And therefore also to their health. Now again, this is normally accepted as, well, kind of an unfortunate part of modern working life. But if we think about it for a minute, in a rational system of production, something like that would be absurd. If the purpose of work was to benefit those people who are doing the work, then it would be absurd if the working process itself and the labor process ruined the health of the people who are to benefit from it. That would be an entire contradiction to the entire purpose of production. If it were the case that we had a rational system of production producing for needs, well, it would be easy. The labor process and all the necessary tasks would be designed from the very beginning so as to relieve strain and stress. Wouldn't work long, we wouldn't work little. I'm sorry, we wouldn't work as hard. In any case, you'd work so that the working process itself doesn't make you sick, so that you can enjoy the benefits. But, to take the converse, if work does make people sick, systematically so, and if their inability to work threatens their very livelihood, well, the conclusion I draw is then their work serves a different purpose. Work isn't there to benefit those who are doing the work. The different purpose that they do serve is, well, real simple. Simple as it is brutal. Turning money into more money. Enriching the company that employs labor for the sake of its own wealth. Not the benefit of those who are doing the work. The benefit of those who are employing the work for turning an advance of money into more. That's the purpose of their work. My claim, therefore, labor as such doesn't systematically ruin people's health. That's a question of how it's organized. Wage labor makes people sick. Not work as such, but the capitalistic purpose of that work. Well, how does that work? If that's the purpose, turning money into more money, what does that mean for the livelihood of the workers? Well, it essentially means that's a cost burden. Their livelihood, that is, the wages that they earn from work, should cost as little as possible, and for the wages they get, they should perform as much work as possible. This difference, this discrepancy between the amount that they receive for their livelihood and the amount of work that they have to perform, that is the source of wealth that determines the market economy. That is the source of the wealth of this nation. The profits of employers. Well, what does that mean for the working life? Or for working life? What does that mean for people who are cost factors for production? A deduction from the purpose of the economy. Well, what that essentially means is the picture I've just painted, the small little survey I took of the working world. It means working long hours and working hard. For the money you get, put in a lot of work. for the time that you're there, put in a lot of work. Pack as much as you can into the hours that you're there and be there for as many hours as you can. Think of the TV ads. Maximize your output, go the extra mile, sacrifice your free time, go in on that sick day in order to get ahead. What's important to note about that, this is how established this purpose of work is. It's not just the case that employers are yelling at their workers to perform all these things. These advertisements about TV medication or medication on TV make that clear. This is something that workers themselves see as a necessity. They regard their sickness as a real problem. Of course, they don't want to get sick, not just because nobody likes to be sick, but they know it's a threat to their livelihood. They want to be able to perform more. That's how established that purpose is. Well, that's one thing. Those are the consequences for the length and the intensity of the working day, but that's just getting started. What goes for their wages and their working hours also goes for the conditions of their work. If the purpose is to minimize costs and maximize output, well, what does that mean for things like health precautions, for heat, noise, dust, and toxins of various kinds? Well, these are also cost burdens. They need to be avoided or minimized if possible. And again, for workers whose pay depends on the amount of work they perform, these precautions are also a burden. If you go into factories, you can find workers trying to circumvent all kinds of safety precautions because they know this is a threat to their wages. They know if they don't risk their health, they have a problem. Potential health dangers are risks that need to be taken in order to earn a sufficient income. And because of that purpose of production, because that is the purpose of work, neither is it the case that technology, which would increases productivity, one could say thus potentially making work easier, making less work necessary for the same amount of product. In this society, because of this purpose of production, technology makes work neither less nor any easier. It doesn't eliminate any sicknesses. At most, it changes the kind of sicknesses that people get. The classic thing, all of a sudden people have tendonitis and backache from sitting in a chair all day instead of lifting thousands of pounds a day. Why is that the case? Why is it the case that technology doesn't do that? Well, same purpose of production. The purpose of technology is not at all to make work easier or less. Not to eliminate work, that's not the purpose. The purpose is to eliminate the labor that companies have to pay for. It's to reduce paid labor, not labor in general. It means lowering the cost of production, increasing the profit margin while undercutting the competition. That's why I'd be wrong to say, well, yeah, sickness comes from modern technology. Sickness comes from computers. Sickness comes from the kind of machines we have nowadays. Not the tools themselves, not the means, but the purpose for which technology is employed. That's the reason. That's why technological advances not only enable people to work longer and faster, it requires them to do so. The cost required for implementing expensive machinery meant to lower wages means those costs have to be caught up. Sorry, these costs have to be recovered. Come on in. That means overtime, night shifts, working faster and longer with fewer pauses. That's the result of technological advance. Again, not because of technology or modern life, but because of the purpose of the economy. Long story short, labor doesn't make people sick, wage labor does. Technology doesn't make people sick, its capitalistic application does. Not the production of useful goods, but the production of profit is responsible for the sicknesses attributed to modern society. Still, that's not it. I talked about in what sense the capitalistic working world is designed with the, well, not with the purpose, but with the necessary result that people get systematically sick. The other side of that is they're systematically unable to access the cure, unable to heal themselves on their own power. Well, why is that the case? Precisely because of the purpose of, wait a second. precisely because of the purpose of the working world, that means that the people's free time is anything but free. What that means instead is that free time is meant for two purposes, R&R, rest and recuperation. Recovery from a working world that makes them ill, recuperation for a working world that makes them ill. The purpose of working life means that their free time is necessarily insufficient for getting well. And that has a few different dimensions. The one dimension is time. Long working hours means less time to rest. People simply don't have the time required to recover from the week. The weekend is awfully short. And not only is the weekend always too short, but anybody who uses the free time for something like enjoyment, yeah, the reason people go to work is for their free time. The second they try to enjoy it, well, that means they have a tough time going into work on Monday. If they go out on Saturday night, if they go out on Friday night, this means that they're less able to perform the coming week. As soon as people use the free time for the purpose of enjoyment, that collides with the objective purpose of their free time. What I mean, the objective purpose is what they really have to use their free time for, what it is functional for, and that is recovering for work. That's just one element. That's the element of time. The other element is probably just as obvious, money. Because of the low wages demanded by the purpose of production, most people are systematically too poor to afford the measures needed to rest and recuperate. House in the countryside? Forget about it. Or even if you do get a house further away from the noise of the city, you've got a nice long drive. Vacation? For most people, an impossibility. A home in noisy neighborhoods is probably more likely. Also because of low wages, this means that there is really no weekend for a lot of people. Maybe they have a second or a third job. Maybe that job is working under the table. Maybe it's over the table. Because of the low wages of work, that means there's a lot of work. Speaking of the countryside, go out and enjoy nature. Well, it's getting more and more difficult. The same reason why health precautions are often neglected or are very minimal, the same thing goes for environmental protection. That's something I probably don't need to say much about. This is something that is well known and yet accepted as just a part of modern life. Pollution everywhere, land, soil, air, water. And finally, food. Antibiotics in the meat, preservatives, too much sugar and salt, and I'll let you go ahead and look at various medical journals to look up on the results of that if you want. Again, keep wanting to make the same point. It's not modern working life that's bad for your health. It's the capitalistic purpose of that work. If we think of the debate, going back to the beginning a little bit, the debate about healthcare reform, and particularly want to pick on the left, who call on the state and its moral obligation to take care of the people. They really regard the state as the address for their concerns, to say, you are the one who has a moral obligation to take care of the people, ignoring or missing the fact that the economy or the reason that they're so sick and unable to pay for the cure, the reason why they need government intervention, is a result of the economy that precisely this government installs and enforces. And that state that they call upon does not prohibit any of these health dangers. Why? Well, the economy that produces these dangers is the economy that the state wants. It's with the laws of private property that this state enforces that it makes people dependent on performing the kind of labor I just talked about. And at the same time, it's the state and its laws on private property that empowers the other side, that is the employers, to make use of the labor in the way I've just talked about, for their enrichment and to the detriment of those that do the work. That's not only the kind of the economy that the state wants, that's the kind of economy that is the source of the state's own wealth and power. That's the one side of the issue. The state doesn't eliminate any of these dangers. At the same time, this economy that the state wants undermines one of its own key prerequisites for functioning, one of the key conditions for its own success, and that is the health of the population. Not only is that a key prerequisite for the economy, but also for the manifold purposes that the state itself has in store for the people. One of those things, and one of the particularly important tasks, is the military. Military is one of the major reasons why a state has an interest in preserving this key prerequisite for the economy and for state purposes. What comes out of this contradiction, the fact that the state wants and installs this kind of economy, and the fact that this economy undermines what it is that the state wants from the people, their ability to perform for many different tasks, what emerges from that is the need for regulation. And regulation always has two sides. That means forbidding unproductive harm done to people's health, so things like epidemics, those should be eliminated. And it also means, let's say, for more productive ways of ruining people's health. This would be the everyday working world. These health threats need to be dosed, need to be properly dosed. You need to have limits on them. Imposing a limit on something, however, has a flip side. It means forbidding certain kinds of harm to people's health, and it also means explicitly permitting other forms of harm to people's health, up to a certain border. In that sense, the state explicitly exposes people to precisely these health dangers, precisely the same health dangers that the state, or that many on the left, or people in general, call on the state to protect them from. This contradiction, ensuring a sufficiently healthy population for purposes that do systematic harm, the contradiction between the purpose of the economy and the consequences of the economy for its own functioning, for its own operation, this contradiction is the purpose of a modern capitalist state's healthcare policy. That is the object with which healthcare policy deals with. So instead of having a good opinion, or a good fundamental opinion of the fact that the state takes care of healthcare, I'm going to have to point out what a cruel object that is that the state takes care of when it takes care of healthcare. Now I'd be arriving at my second chapter, healthcare policy. What does that entail? What are the various purposes and contradictions that involves? One could picture healthcare policy as a, to use a fancy word, a tripartite contradiction, a three-way contradiction. There are three equally important and equally antagonistic criteria that the state is dealing with. The one point is public health. The state has an interest in this key prerequisite of a functioning economy and a functioning people, a population. That's the one criterion. The other one is the fact that the state insists that medical care, like every other good or service in the market economy, has a price. Every good, the production of every good, the production or the provision of every medical service, that's a business. Private companies are allowed and encouraged to make their money providing these. They should do business in the production and provision of these goods. They should maximize their profits on the production and provision of medical care, be it in the form of medical technology, pharmaceuticals, doctoral care, hospital services, etc. And it's not just any business, but if you take a look at the healthcare industry and the pharmaceutical industry in particular, this is one of the premier growth industries in America and in any advanced economy. The healthcare industry is a huge part of the, or creates a huge part of the wealth that this state wants. If you think about what Obama kept saying when he was justifying making certain compromises on his reform, he said, you know, you can't just come along and radically change 1/6 of the American economy. Well, healthcare accounts for 1/6 of the American economy. And this is an industry that the state wants just as much as it does the healthcare. Well, the problem is these two points, an interest in healthcare or in public health, and an interest in an industry that makes profits on providing health. Well, what that means is that for the overwhelming majority of the population, the price that needs to be paid for this care is simply unaffordable. And it's all the more unaffordable the more urgently it is needed. Really extensive medical care simply is far beyond the reach of most people who make their living working for the enrichment of employers. And I just remember reading a stat, I think I'm right in saying serious illness or medical debts is one of the premier causes of, or maybe the number one cause of bankruptcy in America. That's an illustration of this contradiction. The fact that the state wants both of these things means that health care is absolutely unaffordable for most people. And because of this contradiction between the medical care that people need and the interest of turning money into more money on providing that care, no modern capitalist state leaves the financing of healthcare just up to the vagaries of the market. Instead, the state is faced with the necessity of organizing the requisite purchasing power to do both these things, to allow people to purchase the medical care they need to function at some level, and to provide a financial basis for a booming healthcare industry. But that's not where the contradiction ends. There's different ways of organizing that purchasing power. Different states have different ways of doing it. The UK, for instance, simply gathers in taxes from everybody and treats everybody for free. It's just a part of its budget. In Germany, it functions a little differently from how it does in France. In every case, however, organizing this purchasing power, given the fact that people can't afford it, means imposing some kind of a burden on the economy. On the economy, one would have to say. Right. And that is the profits of business. That might go toward ensuring the desired level of public health, and it might also be useful, well, it is also useful for providing a financial basis for the healthcare industry. At the same time, it creates a burden, or at least from the perspective of the state, an unwanted burden on those that are producing the wealth that it wants. So these three aims, certain level of public health, profitable business in general, and profitable business in particular in the sense of the healthcare industry, all stand in total opposition to each other. Could go through it one more time. The purpose of the market economy means low wages and long working hours. That makes people sick. That's potentially unable to function as citizens, as workers. And it makes them incapable of mustering the financial power needed to support a booming healthcare industry. The state's interest in a certain level of public health, in having the population function for the economy and for whatever other purposes the state has in store for them, means imposing burdens on those whose profits constitute the wealth of the nation. And the principle that medical care is and should be a profitable business entails that it is out of most people's reach, and that the purchasing power required to sustain that business would do undue harm to business in general. So they're all formulations for this tripartite contradiction that is healthcare policy. Well, that has two consequences. The one is that healthcare reform is here to stay. In every country, healthcare reform is a permanent necessity. It's a permanent object of debate. I was reading a little bit in the New York Times, and they had a nice piece on the whole history of the healthcare debate or the issue of healthcare in America, and it turns out since Theodore Roosevelt, it's been on the agenda. There's been presidents who've been trying to, or presidents and politicians who've been trying to bring about healthcare reform for 80 years. In Germany, it's a funny thing. Every 3 years or so, more regular than the Olympics, you have a new healthcare reform that comes about. If you look up in Wikipedia, healthcare reform in Germany, every 3 years you have the big reforms. The reason for that is the whole object is a contradiction. And that's why, depending on which side you look at, it stands in opposition to the other side. That's why it's a constant debate. The second consequence is no two healthcare systems are the same. The various differences you find between different countries and their healthcare systems, well, these are different outcomes of how state and politicians manage to somehow find a connection or a compromise between these three different conflicting goals. It looks different no matter where you look. If we take a look at the particularity of the United States, even in the USA, the home of, let's say, the home of free enterprise, or at least the modern home of free enterprise, the government does not leave the matter of medical care up to the market. Above, I mentioned Medicare and Medicaid are two examples. And there are also a number of programs for the children of uninsured, etc. At the same time, the USA has never had a system of universal health care. And that really does make it an exception among advanced capitalist nations. It's always been rejected because it's simply considered too expensive, too big of a burden on the economy. Instead, the USA has traditionally let the issue of medical care be decided by a fight between capital and labor, so between employers and the unions. And depending on whatever compromises unions manage to wring from the clutches of the employers, or whenever employers make medical care simply a standard part of their working contracts, some kind of health care came out for, I'm not sure what percentage of the population, I think about 2/3. But the results of this healthcare system, this particularity, are pretty well known. On the one hand, certain aspects or certain sectors of America's healthcare industry are simply peerless in terms of their profit market power. The U.S. is also often praised for its medical innovation in all kinds of different fields. There's a nice quote by Bob Dole on that. He said, "America has the best healthcare money can buy. The problem is very few people can afford that healthcare." That's the other half of the U.S. particularity. One could read off the stats, you probably know them. 40-odd million people uninsured, at least that's 15% of the population. A substantial additional portion of the population is underinsured, as it's called. They have insurance formally, but in terms of deductibles, co-pays, and what that insurance actually covers at all, it's not even clear whether they have insurance. Medical debt is the principal cause of bankruptcy, as I pointed out. The U.S. currently has a higher infant mortality rate than most other industrialized nations. In terms of life expectancy, it ranks 42nd in the world, a few spots behind Chile and Cuba. The overall performance of the healthcare system is 72nd in the world. Lack of health insurance causes between, depending on which study you look at, 18,000 and 45,000 so-called unnecessary deaths every year. And the total number of people in the United States who die because of lack of medical care has been estimated to be nearly 100,000 people per year, and so on and so forth. You can go ahead and look at Wikipedia for all the stats. It's not that important. It's just interesting to get a look at what a drastic state.
I'm sorry, I missed the last year. It was 100,000 from what?
From people who die because of lack of medical care, whether insured or uninsured. Now, the more important point is that these health statistics, along with the fact that the USA, as I said, is the only major industrialized country without a system of universal health care, is a point that many on the left really never tire of making. Not even really on the left. Many people in the population point to these statistics as something, as a matter of national shame. And at the same time, and I think Michael Moore, if any of you have seen Sicko, is a typical example of this, points across the border to Canada or points to Europe, makes these countries seem like a virtual paradise for workers.
Comparatively.
What's that?
Comparatively.
Comparatively?
But you're right about the depiction.
I'm sorry, say it again.
You're right about the depiction. It makes it seem like it's really all right. It's not.
Yeah. And what you had said, comparatively it is. Well, comparisons always have two sides. One thing is what makes them different. You could say there are differences in statistics. But what makes them the same? America is unique in terms of these statistics and the way it deals with this issue, but it's only unique in the sense that the government here gives a radical answer to the same brutal question that every state poses when it comes to health care. And the question that it poses is, can we afford health care? Can our economy afford the burden of health care? That's a, like I said, a cruel question. You notice that the question is not, in this society, What does our economy need to perform or to achieve so that people are healthy? This basic prerequisite of any purposes that they might have. It's just the other way around. How much health can our economy sustain? And the fact that a question like that can even get asked proves that the talk of our economy and whether it can afford health care or whether we can afford the level of health care that we have is a lie. On the contrary, there, put it another way, the idea of our economy, whether we can afford it, is a lie in the sense that the question itself makes clear that the economy is not at all there for the sake of people's health. It's just the other way around. Their health care, is there as an instrument of the economy. It's subordinated to the purposes of the economy. That's a proof that it's not our economy, but there's an antagonism between the purposes of the economy and, in this case, the health of the people and their livelihood. The very fact that the question gets asked is a proof of that antagonism. The question is, can we afford to have so many people be sick? Can we afford to pay so much for health? And again, I want to emphasize, this is the very same question that every single capitalist state asks itself, whether in Canada or in Europe or in America. This is the commonality. Therefore, instead of, let's say, pointing out the differences, the comparative advantages of being a proletarian in Europe or being a proletarian in America, it's even questionable if it's any better. Instead, take a look at the way that the state is calculating with the people. Doesn't give you any reason to compare. Instead, it gives you a reason to reject both or all answers to this cruel question. With that, I come to my third chapter, which is the reform here in America, the current reform. So, why reform? Why now? Again, as I pointed out, reform in every capitalist state is a constant necessity because of these different competing and conflicting interests. Now, in America, what was the reason for this reform? Obama, but not only Obama. I would say it this way. They're giving the opposite answer to the same cruel question I was talking about. It said before that usually the answer was, we cannot afford to have universal health care. At least at the starting point of the debate, the answer was, or the diagnosis was, we can no longer afford not to have universal health care. Or we can no longer afford to have so many people uninsured. And for a lot of people, this was a reason for celebration. They said, finally, the government has recognized how important our health is. But I would point out to them in what sense, or according to which perspective, or from which perspective their health is all of a sudden important. Or their sickness is important. Their sickness is a burden for an economy that makes them sick. Here Obama asked the question again, and not Obama, but also even the business community, whole slews of politicians on both sides of the aisle, Nobel Prize winning economists, all asked the same cruel question they always ask, and this time came to a different conclusion. How much healthcare can we afford? Well, certainly we need to afford more than we are now. We can't afford not to expand healthcare for the population. This was really the diagnosis that was at the starting point. Why did they come to this different answer, or arrive at the answer that they currently have? One point is, in a certain sense, the state has in America has always had to pay for the medical care of many sick people who didn't have insurance. The classic illustration of that is all kinds of people who are popping up in emergency rooms when their sickness has really reached a critical stage. And in many cases, you could find stories of people getting turned away from emergency rooms even. But these were high costs for treating these people. And the calculation is that it'd be cheaper to give them some kind of preventive care. So to expand the system of preventive care in order to eliminate the high costs of so many people popping up in the emergency room for diseases that, if caught earlier, would be able to be prevented. This is just one cost calculation. Second, and this is a more important point, the development of the economy itself has led to a decrease in the number of uninsured, I'm sorry, a decrease in the number of insured, an increase in the number of uninsured over the year, over the years. On the one side, the number of uninsured has increased because of companies going bankrupt, industries going under and shedding their former employees. But on the other side, the economy's success has had the same effect. The success of America's economy has led to the same result. Why and how? Well, I talked a little bit about the purpose of technological advance in the production process. The purpose of making advances in productivity. Well, that means two things. First, constant decreases in so-called unit wage costs. You introduce technology into the production process. It doesn't mean reducing labor. It means reducing the amount of paid labor. That is, people perform more work and get less money for that. Wages sink relative to the amount of work performed. And these relative lower wages mean fewer contributions to insurance. Second, fewer workers are needed relative to the amount of work required and performed. Yeah, this is the famous downsizing. Introduce technological advances into the working world. The one half of the working force, or one portion of the working force, works more for less, and the other portion gets thrown out in the street. More unemployed, less people paying for insurance. And the problem is, this makes the insurance business less profitable. Read about the fact that less people getting insurance means a weaker financial basis for the insurance for insurance companies. That is something insurance companies pass on to those that are insured, which means higher premiums, deductibles, and co-payments, a narrow range of services, leading to the exact same thing we talked about, or these statistics we talked about a few minutes ago. Insurance is increasingly unaffordable, and it covers less where it does exist. I want to make a little digression on a certain issue at this point. That, what I just talked about, the advance of this society's productivity leads to a greater amount of sickness and inability to get the cure. That is the real nature of the so-called demographic problem that everybody talks about, both in Europe and America. Yeah? The demographic problem is always illustrated by saying, especially as the baby boomers get closer to retirement, the amount of people who are older are increasing, and there's less active working people in order to pay into the pot to help these people get the medical care they need when they're older. You realize that this demographic problem, even the term itself, describes the relationship as a kind of natural issue, a relationship between young and old. There's more old people, fewer younger people. It's clear that we need to reorganize the healthcare system so that the young can afford to pay for the old. The whole thing is pictured as if everybody's paying into a common pot. The wealth of the nation goes into one pot. There's less people contributing to the pot and more people who have to take out. Well,
it's the people that have paid in for years and years, these so-called baby boomers, of course, that money is gone. Nobody knows about that.
Yeah, that's the one thing that is secure about Social Security. Yeah. The point is the society is pictured as a kind of collective, and healthcare financing is a big pot that everyone pays into and draws from, and that couldn't be less true.
Yeah.
The real demographic problem is a relationship between two other things, not old people and young people. Rather, it's a relationship of the amount of people who need medical care and the amount of people that capital needs for its enrichment. If capital needs less people for its increase, less people get wages, less people are active workers paying into the pot, more people unemployed, more people who, as they're older, no longer useful for capital, therefore a bigger burden. It's not a relationship of young and old, it's a relationship of what does capital need and what does people need. What do the people need in terms of medical care? That's the antagonism that is the so-called demographic problem. This is a small but important digression on that point. In any case...
Isn't there a certain amount of borrowing against those funds set aside that have been put aside by the workers all these years, that the money no longer actually exists in those repositories, but is owed to those repositories. I'm not sure how well I can reference that, but I seem to remember something like that.
Well, maybe someone else could say more about this if they're more familiar.
Just put it in there as a thought, you know, that they don't want it to be paid back because they vowed a damn war, you know.
I wouldn't really know what to say about that, actually.
I think there's some consideration to be made about that. Anyway, not right now.
Okay. Maybe we can get back to
it. They've been having surpluses, you know, and I'm sure the money just doesn't sit there. They go out and buy government bonds or whatever, so it's essentially a lending mechanism.
And that, yeah.
But I think what the speaker here is saying is, and I'd like to add another point, is everyone knows the last 20 years salaries and wages on average have not only been stagnant, but added inflation.
Right.
So there's less of a pot, so to speak, to draw upon for.
Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, how many chapters do you have?
I'm getting near the end. Am I testing the page, or do you want to postpone this question to the end, you mean? Or?
No, I was just interested in finding. I'm not trying to do anything.
No, that's fine. I was wondering, do you mean about this question?
No, that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe this other point about the pot again. It's often, especially in Germany, it's described as a cake. Yeah, the cake has to be bigger in order for it to be spread around. And again, the image is always, there's a big cake that everyone pays into and everyone eats from. Yeah, everyone, I don't know how to, I'm not sure if you can pay into a cake, but it doesn't matter. And the idea is everybody eats then from the whole cake. And so if there's less people paying in, there's less people who can get out of it, or get things out of it. Sugar, maybe. The reality is that the entirety of the working population needs to be, let's say, concentrated into the one piece of the pie that's called wages. In essence, this demographic problem is really one portion of the working class paying for the other. Deductions from the wages, especially clear when it comes to Medicare. Deduction, payroll taxes, deductions from wages used to pay those members of the working class who are no longer needed for capital. The entirety of the population is obligated to feed on this small piece of the cake that is the wealth of the nation. Yeah. That is the pot. Again, the relationship is not what do we all pay in and what can we all take out, but how many people does capital need, and how many people do need medical care? That's the antagonism. Okay. Back to the diagnosis. This combination of rising costs for healthcare on the one hand, and the rising amount of uninsured has occasioned not only Obama, but Republicans on both, Democrats and Republicans, so politicians on both sides of the aisle, a whole bunch of Nobel Prize-winning economists and even business in general to call for an overhaul of the healthcare system. And I don't really want to go too much into the ins and outs of the reforms, but what I want to reflect on a little more is the character of this diagnosis. Well, what was the diagnosis that led to the reform? America spends more on healthcare than any other country, while America's health statistics are worse than most other industrialized nations. Yeah, Obama would get up and say, we pay more for healthcare than any other advanced nation, or I think any other nation, and we get less out of it. That's a problem for the budget, and that's a problem for the competitiveness of the economy. I want to talk about the nature of that diagnosis. That's something one should reflect on for a moment. This diagnosis is as frightening as it is instructive. What does it tell us? The problem that Obama is addressing is not so much poor people's health, or rather, people's poor health, but what that can mean for something much more important than their health. The health of the budget, so the solidity of the budget, and the health of the companies that make use of those workers, that make use of the people. The problem that their poor health might cause, well, you could say that's an injury to the ability of the nation's economy to compete against others. That's a nice illustration of what I was talking about before, what public health really means. It doesn't mean whether people are healthy, but whether the state of their health and their medical care represents a burden for the nation's budget and for the competitiveness of its economy. The economy's not there for them, they're there for the economy. Their poor health as such is not necessarily a problem, It's what that poor health could mean for the health of more important purposes to which they're subordinated. The second point is, it teaches us what the criterion is for public health. Throughout the talk, I've mentioned several times, the state has a certain interest in a certain level of public health. Well, there's no real objective criterion for how much health is enough or how much sickness is too much. There's no objective yardstick for measuring that. But the yardstick that does get applied, in this case most explicitly, really gets to the heart of what people's health is there for in the first place. When Obama looks abroad and sees this discrepancy between what America pays for healthcare and what it gets, and that what other countries pay for healthcare and what they get, the question he's asking is, okay, our health statistics are worse and we pay more. Is that a disadvantage for our competitiveness? Is that a disadvantage for us in our competition with other nations? Again, the economy is not there for the people, but in this case, it's an instrument not only for the economy, but for the state in its international competition. Healthcare, it turns out, is even important for imperialism. The cure that is being discussed for this diagnosis, well, on the basis of this diagnosis, one could say rather the debate over the cure between politicians, corresponds to the nature of this diagnosis. What I want to do is just to point out a few specific things about the Democrats and their bill that they presented and the Republicans. Again, don't want to go into too much detail, I just want to pick out a few fundamental things. Two elements of the Democratic bills I want to point out. The one is the, and this will probably get into the final version, the obligation to get insurance, the obligation of everybody to buy insurance. The second thing I want to talk about is the obligation to offer insurance, both companies and insurance companies. First thing, an obligation to get insurance. What does that teach us? That's interesting. The starting point was people are unable to afford the cost of medical care. They're too poor to afford insurance. What's the solution? Force them to get insurance. That's a really nice illustration of what the problem of their poverty and their sickness is. It could create rising costs. People, therefore, have to make a financial sacrifice in order to save the state costs for medical care down the line and to provide a more robust financial basis for insurance companies and the healthcare industry. And the calculation is if more people are involved in the insurance or are paying insurance, insurance is more profitable, insurance companies have more market power, hopefully they can reduce premiums and force down the prices of drugs and medical care. Again, it's not about eliminating the causes for people's poverty-induced illness, but about eliminating the problems that that could cause.
There's a likelihood of suit against it as unconstitutional. And I forget the phrasing. It's something about the relationship of requiring people to buy a product.
Mm-hmm.
A particular product.
Mm-hmm. What's that? Sorry.
They do the same with auto insurance. I don't think they'll have a problem.
What I would say about that, too, is the nature of your objection saying, well, that's not really constitutional. What I would say is, at that point, if you find out that this is the kind of calculation that's going on, instead of asking, well, are politicians really allowed to do that? Can the state really act that way? First of all, to take note of the fact the state does act that way, and then take that seriously.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, understand that it could be that they find out, well, we're not actually allowed to do this. They might have to take something back or find some kind of compromise. What the point I really want to get at here is just the nature of the calculations they have. And the logical, let's say, the nature of these calculations is somewhat logical given the way that they view people's public health. And the reason that they view public health is not just some individual moral failing, but it's a consequence of the economy itself. These people's livelihood, their health, is on the one hand a necessary prerequisite for the functioning of the economy. On the other hand, it's a cost burden on the economy, and the economy makes them sick. That's really the point I would emphasize. And here, really the point is with the obligation to get insurance. People have to make a financial sacrifice for their own health care that they can't afford so that the state and the economy can save on costs further down the line. The state will help them do that. with various kinds of subsidies, maybe tax breaks, but it's unclear what's even going to come of that. The second part, obligation to give insurance or to offer insurance. The one element that it looks like is going to get into the final version of the bill is insurance companies are no longer allowed to deny people because of pre-existing conditions, and also won't be allowed to drop people once those people get ill, to drop their insurance. And there's various other kinds of regulations. It's unclear whether they'll get passed. Things like obligating insurance companies to use a certain portion of their profits for providing medical care instead of profits or instead of investments, really forced to take their earnings and reinvest them into medical care. Also, things like these insurance exchanges, or in general, rules about becoming more transparent, giving people a better or a clearer choice between different insurance premiums. It's supposed to create more competition, et cetera, et cetera. What I want to talk about at this point, all these obligations that are being imposed on the insurance industry, on the one hand, they're to be taken seriously. You notice the state does have an interest in ensuring some kind of public health and obligating not only people to make a financial sacrifice, but also capital. On the other hand, what is the nature of that obligation? The nature of the obligation is these companies should be forced to provide insurance and to make and to do business with it. They should be forced to make a profit on providing health care. They should fulfill this certain function for the state's interest and make a profit on it. That's a nice illustration of the way that the state manages this contradiction. They should be able to do business. They should be able to make profits. But while fulfilling a need that the state has for these people's health. One thing is clear, health will not come out of it. Maybe some public health. A functional equivalent of health, not the same thing. Second thing, obligation for employers to offer some kind of an insurance plan. Now it's unsure what will come of that, but same thing. Companies should pay some kind of a, not a penalty, if they don't pay, or if they don't offer insurance, they have to pay a penalty. But companies should make some kind of financial contribution to their own ability to make use of the labor of workers for their own enrichment. That's the nature of the obligation. Might have to pay higher taxes, they might get tax breaks. In any case, they have to offer some kind of insurance. That is an obligation. It is imposing a burden on capital. But what kind of a burden is it? Contribute your part to the maintenance of the source of your own wealth. Contribute something so that you can continue to profit on these people to their detriment. That's the nature of the obligation. So much for the Republican, for the Democrats. What about the Republican opposition? Maybe it's just a small point, but it's important. At the moment, the Republicans have a very bad reputation among the left, obstructing this landmark piece of reform, doing all they can to prohibit people from finally getting the medical care that they need, really being interested in just seeing people rot and die, so that insurance can make a lot of money and capital doesn't get burdened. Well, that's not quite right. In fact, it's probably worse than that. The Republicans haven't been saying, oh, screw it, we don't care if people die. We want profits. They themselves point out that the healthcare reform that's being brought about certainly might not lead to anything like an improvement of health. They point out instead that extending healthcare to more people would mean spreading healthcare thin. It would mean underinsurance for many more people. Even worse state of insurance, even worse state of medical care for the overwhelming majority. They point out that many people will not be able to afford the compulsory insurance, the insurance that the state requires of them. They point out that would mean an increase of poverty across the board and lower care, quality of care across the board. What I would say about that is that shows how much that this faction of the state takes the poverty of the people for granted. Quality care for all is simply out of the question. And on that point, they're in agreement with the Democrats. High quality of health care for all is a fantasy world that the American economies cannot afford. For the Democrats, that takes the form of saying they have to pay a financial sacrifice so that they can get any kind of care, and we know this might not be the best care, but it will reduce costs. It's the way they agree to that point. The Republicans may be a little starker, and they say it's more of a stark expression of that same point. They say, it's clear from the beginning not everybody's going to be able to get care. This will mean just worsening health care for those that have insurance. And this point of agreement, that this economy simply cannot afford the health care of the people, simply cannot afford medical care. Yeah, this is a question that people should ask, or this is a question, or put it another way. That diagnosis, this economy cannot afford their medical care. If that's the case, people should ask themselves if they can afford this economic system. That's it. Questions, comments, need for discussion, go for it.
Yeah, can you go into...